It was in Cornwall that the English novelist Daphne du Maurier imagined her Machiavellian plots. Director Alfred Hitchcock adapted three of her works, Jamaica Inn, Rebecca, and The Birds. Rebecca became a worldwide success, has sold over 30 million copies, and has been translated into nearly every language. Daphne du Maurier wrote about 20 novels and numerous short stories, and yet it is Rebecca who haunts the work and the life of the author. In 1937, Daphne du Maurier is 30 years old. She has already written several best-selling novels, notably Jamaica Inn. She must, however, still follow her husband, Major Frederick Browning, to Alexandria, where he is stationed. For Daphne, who loves solitude, the mundane life of a military woman is torture. The stifling heat and odors are bothersome. The Sea of Cornwall haunts her thoughts. In a few months, she writes the first draft of Rebecca. The novel takes place in Manderley, actually Menabilly, an abandoned estate that Daphne and her sister discovered one afternoon during the fall.
For me, the idea of a story arises very often by accident. Like for a novel, it's a slow infusion, but because of its magnitude, a novel will go deeper into the emotional life. Something starts to rise inside you in an irrepressible way. Before you know it, the novel begins to meddle in your life. It's like waiting for a child. He grows up in you. He becomes a part of you, like a double.
Feel this. It was a Christmas present from Mr. De Winter. He was always giving her expensive gifts. The whole year round. I keep her underwear on this side. They were made specially for her by the nuns in the convent of St. Clair.
The theme is jealousy. The narrator's jealousy of Rebecca, Maxim's first wife. One day I happened upon letters written by Jan Ricardo, my husband's ex-fiancé. They were innocent letters, of no import, but preserved in time. The handwriting, drawn with a firm hand, revealed that this woman was far more confident and audacious than I.
Both Rebecca de Winter and the new Mrs. de Winter are part of Daphne's own character. So Rebecca has the independence, she has the power, she likes to sail, so she has lots of qualities of Daphne herself. But so does the new Mrs. de Winter, the shyness, feeling ill at ease in social situations. So Daphne splits her own personality in these two women in the novel.
Last night I dreamt I went to Manderley again. In the first scene, the narrator moves in a waking dream, a notion invented by Daphne's grandfather, Georges de Maurier, born in Paris in 1834 and died in 1896. Like many of his contemporaries, he experimented with hypnosis. Musician, painter, and satirical cartoonist, he gained international fame thanks to his two novels, Peter Ibbetson and Trilby. When Daphne was born, May 13th, 1907, the name du Maurier is already famous. Her parents live in the elegant neighborhood of Hampstead, north of London, in accordance with the codes of the Victorian era. They lead a lavish lifestyle and receive with great pomp the London gentry. But they are also bohemian artists. The family legend says that the du Mauriers were aristocrats who immigrated to England during the French Revolution, abandoning their castle and their land.
This family was very, very proud of their French blood. And actually, she learned how to pronounce her name. She wouldn't say Dumouriez, but Dumouriez.
Daphne would discover much later that they were only simple glassblowers riddled with debt. But the romanticized version was never questioned, neither by her grandfather nor by her father, Gerald, one of the most popular actors of his generation.
He was the favorite actor of Barry, who was the father of Peter Pan, the famous play that was so important in the upbringing and imagination of the three Dumouriez sisters. Her mother was an actress too. Her name was Muriel Beaumont, but she stopped performing when she got married. And so the theater and the entertainment world was very important for the Dumouriez family. Daphne called it the land of make-believe, the imaginary world that, coincidentally, connects her to Peter Pan. And above all, there was this father, unbearable for some, admirable and funny as all for others. The actor father, able to imitate people behind their backs, to make faces, to make everyone roar with laughter.
The Dumouriez speak in a coded language. They play make-believe. Daphne dresses up as Peter Pan or incarnates Eric Avon, her male alter ego that allows her to swap dresses for boys' clothes. She becomes thus a flamboyant hero who fights dragons to save her sisters dressed up as princesses.
Daphne wanted to be the famous boy that her father would have loved to have. She even wrote a very, very awkward poem when she was 13, 14 years old. And sometimes in the silent of the night, I wake and think perhaps my darling's right, and that she should have been, and if I'd had my way, she would have been a boy.
Daphne, at 10, was taken to the first night, as she was to any of her father's plays, Dear Brutus, which became one of his most famous plays. She saw her father playing her father. She saw that she had been pegged on the little girl, as Barry would do. And it was about a man who was fed up with life and felt he'd let it go by. And he goes out into a magic wood and he makes an imaginary daughter. And the play is mostly about the relationship between the father and the daughter, and the relationship is very odd. He's crawling all over her and so on and so forth. It is sort of bordering on incestuous. And she watched her father in the last act rub this imaginary girl out of his life. And she was so caught up with it, she burst into tears and ran from the audience.
So what strikes me about Daphne as a teenager is the image of her at Cannon Hall, the image of a young girl not shy, but who did not like the contact with others. In any case, not with people she didn't know. She was obliged to play the role of a young girl from a good family, but someone who already had her world. She walked about with a pencil behind her ear and a notebook, since she was taking notes, keeping a diary. Thus, a teenager who was nothing like her sister Angela or her younger sister Jean, she was already in her own world. At that time, I was never myself. I identified with the characters in the books I'd read and those that interested me at the moment. Poems and short stories began to gush from my pen, but they were rarely finished.
Daphne du Maurier had a huge number of literary influences. She was an incredible reader when she was younger, getting through up to 4 or 5 books a week. The Brontes were a huge influence on her work, and she continued to read the Brontes all the way through her life. She was also reading French literature, Maupassant and Zola. She read everything she could get her hands on.
Daphne du Maurier est partie vivre.
In 1926, Daphne went to live in France in Meudon, in what was called a finishing school, a boarding school for young girls, rather chic. She gained the acquaintance of the headmistress of the boarding school, a certain Fernande Yvonne, who was 12 years older than she. Bubbly, funny, very French.
Très française.
In fact, this woman I told you about, Miss Yvonne, a fatal attraction. She has completely bewitched me. Here I am caught in her net.
Daphne
describes this kind of attraction that she felt for Fernande Yvonne as if it were Eric Avon. All of a sudden,
Eric Avon,
who wanted to give Fernande flowers,
d'offrir des fleurs à Fernande.
They were almost masculine gestures she had towards this woman. She believed that deep inside her lived a boy in a box, which she called the boy in the box.
On the arm of Fernande, Daphne discovers the Paris of the 1920s, the cafes of Montparnasse, where one rubs elbows with American authors Gertrude Stein, Hemingway, and Fitzgerald. Encouraged by Fernande, Daphne begins to write short stories, notably The Doll, rejected by publishers, scandalized by the thought that this girl from a good family could be its author.
Daphne herself is really interested in thinking about the role of the modern woman, particularly the sexually independent modern woman. And we see that coming through in her very early story, The Doll, in which the main character, Rebecca, perhaps a model for her later, Rebecca de Winter, has this this doll, possibly some kind of sex doll, that she's able to control, and she asserts her independence away from the male narrator through her control of this doll.
Regretfully, Daphne has to leave Paris. Her relationship with Fernande remains passionate, however, but she is 20 years old and intoxicated by her power of seduction. In 1928, London is in full swing. Thanks to the suffragettes, British women gain the right to vote. The Bloomsbury Group, a circle of artists and intellectuals in Cambridge who reject as a whole the principles of the Victorian era, dominates the art scene. Virginia Woolf publishes Orlando, the famous novel where the protagonist changes sex during the narration. Daphne and her sisters have become young women, and all of them begin to show off their independence. Unlike the exhilarating atmosphere that reigns in London, Cannon Hall is overbearing. Gerald will not tolerate his daughter's behavior. When Daphne is accompanied by her fling, a young director, Carol Reed, her father subjects him to humiliating interrogations. Gerald relies on Victorian principles to reproach his daughters for their behavior, while he himself never hides from his infidelities. Without the encouragement of Fernande, Daphne struggles to write. Her spirit's crushed. She longs for their complicity. Her parents worry about her melancholy demeanor. Daphne has always loved the great outdoors, and the Desmouriers decide to buy a house by the sea. She reluctantly goes with her family to Cornwall. Once she sees the moor, however, she is instantly seduced. She rediscovers the sensations provoked by the books she'd read as a teenager, Jane Eyre, Wuthering Heights.
She loved the fact that she lived in a land that had myths and legends associated with it. Cornwall was very remote from cosmopolitan England, from London, from the society of theatre and writers that she had grown up in. And one thing that appealed to her about Cornwall was that it seemed to be telling stories that had very deep, long histories, but also that captured something of a kind of eternal note of sadness and suffering.
Far from London and its conventions, Daphne feels free. She spends her time sashaying through the village of Fowley and its surroundings. She makes friends among the fishermen and learns to sail. When her family sets out to return to London, she asks her parents for permission to stay alone in their new house, Ferryside.
One day, while walking towards Pont Creek, I came across the wreckage of a schooner named Jane Slade. She lay in the mud, abandoned. Her hull was rotting, but her figurehead, with bright colors, proudly defied the passage of time. It was then that a member of the Slade family arrived with a large box full of letters and family papers. By that evening, I had read them all. The ink, nearly erased, took me back to the beginning of the 19th century. There was something very intimate in those letters. It felt like I was opening coffins and examining the dead. The following day, I couldn't stop thinking about it, and I realized there was enough material there to write a novel.
Daphne was not a modernist. She was, in a sense, a good old-fashioned storyteller. She believed in narrative. She believed in character. She told page-turners. She was quickly successful with The Loving Spirit, and her subsequent novels made her a popular writer, which removed her from the elite group of modernist writers and took her away from cultural respectability, if you like.
Daphne is 25 years old, and buoyed by the success of The Loving Spirit, she works on different styles. She writes I'll Never Be Young Again and The Progress of Julius, where a possessive father drowns his daughter. She doesn't fear Gerald's reaction. Thanks to her copyrights, she starts becoming financially independent and breaks away from her father. But if the author masters her characters, the success of her novels generates unpredictable events in her life.
One day she's with her sister in Ferryside, and all of a sudden, her sister says to her, "You must come see. There's a brown-haired man, absolutely threatening." In Du Maurier code, threatening meant to send you head over heels. Incredibly beautiful. "There's a brown-haired man who's going up and back in a white boat. You have to come see." So Daphne goes, and in fact, there's a splendid young man who seems to be walking past the house, hoping desperately to see something. And she'll soon discover that this is the young Major Browning, a man with a very strong appearance, a manly man, but inwardly quite fragile. And this young man had heard of Daphne du Maurier, had seen her picture, had read her first novel, The Loving Spirit, and their story began like that.
Though very much in love, Daphne is in no hurry to get married. But Tommy, older and more conventional, doesn't want a relationship without a commitment. 3 months later, she is the one who asks for his hand in marriage. The ceremony takes place at 7 a.m. in the intimacy of the Church of Lantiglos, like the heroine of her first novel, The Loving Spirit. The Brownings would have two daughters, Tessa and Flavia, then a son, Christian, whom they nickname Kitts. Gerald greatly appreciates Tommy Browning, but the marriage of his favorite daughter only worsens his melancholy. He dies of cancer 2 years later.
Her father was really interested in birds and used to go bird spotting and used to actually buy them and set them free when she was a child. So I think she always knew how important birds were and how much her father loved them, and so she loved them too. When he died, she didn't go to his funeral. She went on to Hampstead Heath and let some birds go. But then her father died and she wrote his biography, and that really brought her to people's attention, I think, because it was a very candid biography at the time. It was quite... She was quite open about her father, quite shocked his contemporaries who were concerned that their daughters might write similar biographies about them, because it was quite, quite candid and open in what she said about him.
The biography of Gerald is Daphne's first collaboration with her new publisher, Victor Galanz, who would become a valuable collaborator. After Jamaica Inn, in which Daphne demonstrates her mastery of the bestseller, Galanz gives her an advance for the next novel of £1,000, the equivalent of 18 months of her husband's salary. When Galanz receives the first chapters of Rebecca, he decides to invest in a massive and unprecedented advertising campaign. In order to attract female readers, he presents Rebecca as a sentimental romance, which strongly displeases Daphne.
Announcing the return of the most glamorous motion picture ever made, David O. Selznick and Alfred Hitchcock bring you the Grand Slam Prize winner.
In 1939, Hollywood producer David Selznick hires Alfred Hitchcock to adapt Rebecca. Only the ending would be reworked. The film is a worldwide success.
Hitchcock, with adaptation of Rebecca, he had to make some changes because Maxim kills Rebecca, but he's in many ways the hero of the story. And it was very problematic at that time to show a hero getting away with murder. I think there's a number of reasons why Hitchcock was very attracted to du Maurier's work, partly because he was fascinated by tales of suspense, thrillers, mystery. That was something he was really interested in. But I think also because du Maurier is a very visual writer. She translates to the cinema screen very well. So I think that's one of the things that Hitchcock saw in her work.
War approaches. Tommy must join his regiment north of London. Daphne and the kids go with him, but he is more and more on edge. He's one of those young, high-ranking military men traumatized by the First World War. Daphne writes a few stories for a pacifist movement, adapts Rebecca for the theater, and then she falls under the spell of the gentleman farmer who lodges them and inspires her love story, Frenchman's Creek. Through writing, Daphne lets herself get trapped by her characters. Her relationship with her host becomes ambiguous, and his wife discovers them in an embarrassing situation. To avoid a scandal, Daphne leaves hurriedly with her two daughters and her youngest child. London is being bombed. Daphne takes refuge in Cornwall. In 1943, Daphne is 36 years old, and thanks to the copyrights to Rebecca, rich. She asks the owner of Menabilly, Dr. Rashleigh, to rent her his estate. To Daphne's great joy, he accepts.
It was then that it all began. Not the Battle of Britain or the offensive on the weakened Europe that my husband commanded from Africa, but my personal battle to settle in Menabilly before winter. You go crazy. There's no electricity, no running water, no heating. You'll never find servants. It's impossible. Summer gave way to autumn, autumn to winter, and in December, the moving trucks arrived. Madness finally paid off.
And she literally loved the house. Her children would say she would put her arms out to the walls and hug the house. She absolutely loved it.
Victor Galanz asks his flagship author to welcome a photographer to her house for the publicity of the books. This photo shoot is an occasion for fits of laughter between Daphne and her children, to whom she has transmitted her sense of humor. Very du Maurier, mocking and incisive. The pictures show Daphne as an accomplished mother. In reality, everything concerning the house is relegated to servants, children to nannies, and to the faithful governess Todd, Maud Waddell.
I think domestic life was very problematic for Daphne du Maurier. She couldn't cook. She bought in domestic help. She didn't really notice that there were kind of creatures in the attic. There were rats running up and down the walls. For her, being a mother was really about being a sort of friend and a kind of role model rather than being a carer. She was not really a caring mother. Though she did express very different feelings towards her children, and she was very cuddly towards her son.
Quand nous sommes emménagés à Ménébélé, c'était l'hiver, il faisait tellement froid. I used to read a lot, and my sister rode, she had a pony, so she loved riding. And my brother used to play with them. We used to play with the other children from the farm. And so we spoke, as children, we were bilingual in broad Cornish, which you don't really hear these days. I had two goats, which I loved. And yes, I was very, very fond of them. And came in once, and they jumped on the piano and knocked off it over the flowers. My mother loved arranging flowers. She was a great flower arranger, and we always had the house with a lot of flowers. So she was not pleased when the goats jumped and knocked over the flowers onto the piano. Je ne l'aimais pas beaucoup, cette maison. J'avais trouvé que c'était un peu mystérieuse, trop mystérieuse, cette maison.
On this day, on this night, she is mine and I am hers. At midnight, though the children slept and everything was silent and still, I sat at the piano, looking at the woodwork, and quietly, quietly, without witnesses, whispering, the house murmured her secrets, and her secrets transformed into stories. In these moments, in a strange and disturbing way, we were one, the house and I.
I think she liked the idea that this was, as it were, a sort of castle where she could imagine she was a figure from history. She could imagine that there, she could imagine all the generations of people and lives that had existed there before her.
In Ménébélé, in her cabin at the end of the garden, Daphne isolates herself and imagines her first novel, The King General, which takes place between those walls and is inspired by Dr. Rashleigh's ancestors.
Quand elle était en train d'écrire ce livre-là, elle nous a raconté les chapitres peut-être qu'elle a écrit pendant ce jour-là. Oui.
In early 1945, Daphne is upset by the announcement of Tommy's return. She has become accustomed to living alone and fears that he will disrupt her work habits. Once they are reunited, after 4 years of separation, living together becomes difficult. Yet, Tommy makes an effort, and when his duties call him back to London, he presumes that Daphne and the children will go with him.
À un moment, il lui dit,
he says to her one day, it'd be nice if you come back to live with me in London. She does not hesitate, not for a second. She says to him, but no, I will come from time to time when it's necessary. So every weekend, Tommy Browning would take the train and go back to Cornwall to be with his family.
En Cornouailles.
There is a permanent duality in the life of Daphne du Maurier because there is Daphne du Maurier, the writer. She's generally quite alone. She loves her solitude, and her children and her family have learned to respect her solitude. And then there is Lady Browning, since indeed her husband was ennobled after the war. He was named treasurer of the young Princess Elizabeth, the future queen. And here, she must also fall into line.
Daphne has to go to London often to accompany her husband at Buckingham Palace. Once her sartorial problems are solved, she is not insensitive to the splendor of the ceremonies. At Balmoral, she meets the Queen Mother, who also appreciates her novels. Nevertheless, she begins again to resemble that character, the young and shy Mrs. de Winter.
I always had the feeling I was falling off my chair. What a relief to finally be back home.
She married an army major who went to work for the royal family, for heaven's sake. You know, the Duke of Edinburgh came and stayed overnight in her home. She was part of an establishment marriage, and she wanted to be an establishment figure. She wanted to do the right thing by her husband and children. But at the same time, there was what she called the boy in the box. There was the sort of masculine side of Daphne du Maurier, which she kept trying to put the lid on. And the masculine part was, I think, what she identified as the free, the liberated, the adventurous part of herself.
In 1947, Daphne du Maurier is a world-renowned author. Hitchcock's adaptation of Rebecca is an international success.
And one day, disaster. Her American publisher, Nelson Doubleday, calls her and tells her that, in fact, she has to come over because there's a certain Mrs. Edwina MacDonald who wrote a short story called Blind Windows. And supposedly, this short story inspired Daphne du Maurier to write Rebecca.
Of course, she hadn't done anything of the sort, but she had to then go to America to answer this plagiarism charge.
She's quite upset because, first of all, she doesn't know what she's going to say before the judges, because there's a trial. She'll have to face the press, journalists, who will ask her all sorts of questions. And so she arrived on this cruise ship in luxury, it must be said, because her American publisher spoiled her. She was truly an author who sold a lot, so she was pampered. And there on the boat, there was this one and only Ellen Doubleday, the wife of Nelson Doubleday, who came to pick her up and bring her back. And there, Daphne du Maurier falls madly in love with this woman. Eric Avon gets out of his box. The boy in the box bursts free.
In some ways, Ellen had some of the characteristics of Rebecca de Winter. She was incredibly attractive. She was a great hostess. She socialized with all sorts of different people. And Daphne immediately was fascinated by Ellen.
For several days, troubled by the appearance of her publisher's wife, Daphne avoids the cruise ship lounges. But Ellen's delicate attentions make her irresistible. On their Long Island property, Nelson and Ellen Doubleday receive her as a queen. She is enchanted by the refined luxury of the well-heated house. Like Rebecca de Winter, Ellen reigns over her domain and rules her world with ease. Every day, a driver takes Daphne into Manhattan, where the trial takes place. In the huge Cadillac, she remembers her passionate exchanges with Ellen. Before the U.S. judges, the interrogations are torture. How can she explain to them that Rebecca was born out of her jealousy of Tommy's ex-fiancé, and that she is also part of her? Guilty of her own infidelities, real and imagined, Daphne is terrified. If only they knew. Her life is but a web of lies.
She came back to Menabili, to Mandalay, and she'd won the court case anyway, it didn't matter, but she had been shaken, shaken out, really, of the path that she was on.
When she returned to London, her husband came to pick her up. She was a wreck and she collapsed. She collapsed because she realized to what extent Ellen Doubleday had a hold on her.
Reality and fantasy, you know, came together and didn't mix, and she had a breakdown. What I'm absolutely convinced is that she had a nervous breakdown, which is not some light little sickness. because for the first time she realized that this whole fantasy world in which she lived was getting out of hand again, as indeed they'd worried that it had been before in the 1920s, before she started living at Ferryside. And she went back with all kinds of good intentions to try and pull back on what was going on. Unfortunately, she wrote a play called September Tide.
As always, writing is her outlet. In 2 weeks, Daphne dreams up a play that depicts a forbidden love between a mother-in-law and her stepson.
When the actresses are chosen to play the role of Stella, all the great actresses of the moment fight to get this role because it's quite a handsome role for an actress 40 or 50 years old. It's the famous Gertrude Lawrence who is chosen, the actress with a Cockney accent, the very beautiful actress who was also one of the many mistresses of Gérald du Maurier, Daphne's father.
Le père de Daphné.
Gertrude Lawrence was really the last one. He was always being flattered by women, and there's this sort of thing that they used to talk about his stable of women as if it was some sort of joke and just accepted. And he talked to the girls about it, which seems really odd. And Muriel must have known and must have been very hurt.
But what's amazing is that when Gertie started playing Stella on stage, Daphne felt like Gertie was taking on Ellen's features on whom she had modeled Stella. And so there was a kind of love transference. Daphne felt attracted to Gertrude Lawrence.
By Gertrude Lawrence.
Yes, and that's a strange relationship. They were very close. Gertrude was such a different person. She was so full of fun and daring, and, you know, suddenly Daphne was sort of prepared to leave Menabilly and go chasing off around the country with Gertrude and the play and everything. So it was a crazy time for Daphne, really.
Despite the presence of Gertie, Daphne is still obsessed with the beautiful American. But Ellen keeps her distance in order to prevent her friend from deluding herself. Daphne's frustration would serve as the driving force behind the writing of My Cousin Rachel. This novel elicits the enthusiasm of readers. And for once, critics recognize in it the same power as Rebecca, though perhaps even more believable.
It's true that what's so interesting in My Cousin Rachel, which is the story of a young man, there again we are inside Daphne, who takes on her alter ego, Eric Avon. This young man falls madly in love with an older woman.
Remember once I told you, there was nothing else I needed but the warmth and comfort of these four walls.
I remember.
I was wrong. I know now that there's something else.
Are you very sure of that?
More sure than of anything else on earth.
She is the spitting image of Ellen Doubleday. It's a book that shows a woman half angel, half demon. We don't know really if this famous Rachel Ellen is a poisoner or not. But what we do know is that in writing this book, Daphne du Maurier managed to get rid of what she called this hook, this peg, literally a peg on which she hung a combination of fantasy and reality. That's what allowed her to write, maybe because that was also what gave her her intensities, as if she had put in this book everything she wanted to free herself of, including Ellen's hold on her, and perhaps what she had experienced with Gertie.
Daphne continues by writing a series of grim short stories. The Birds, the most disturbing, would be adapted a few years later by Hitchcock following his huge success, Psycho.
Beautiful cage, fresh water, neither birds to bother you, none of that blinding sunlight. Oh! Now, why would he do that? Most peculiar. What on earth?
Daphne's really fascinated by animals. Lots of the short stories look at the boundaries between the human and the animal. The Blue Lenses is one of her most terrifying stories, where the main character, Marda West, has these blue lenses fitted to her eyes, and all of a sudden she can see more clearly than she could see before. Her favourite nurse, who she really trusted, has suddenly become a snake. Her husband's become a vulture. And of course, the twist in the tale is that when the lenses are changed and the supposed problem has been corrected, when she then looks in the mirror, she sees herself as a deer, as some kind of sacrificial victim.
At the end of the summer of 52, Gertie is hospitalized. Daphne has a premonition. On September 6th, the news arrives at Menabilly. At 54, Gertie was taken by cancer. Cloistered in her room, Daphne listens to the radio, to the heart-wrenching testimonials of her Gertie. She also learns that she was buried in her pink crinoline, that Marlene Dietrich attended the ceremony, and that to pay homage to the actress, Broadway was plunged into darkness for 3 whole minutes. Daphne is crushed. Tommy and the kids don't understand how the death of the actress could affect her so. 10 days later, Daphne confides in Ellen.
I couldn't talk to her as I could with you, of course. But she was so warm and so generous. If you see what I mean. That I cannot imagine that there could be another person on earth like her.
For the first time, the long, rainy, solitary days at Menabilly weigh heavy on Daphne. She is 45, her writing becomes more laborious, and she feels old. Weekends with Tommy, who is also depressed, are a dreadful bore. To try to understand why she cannot come out of her depression, she gets interested in psychoanalysis and reads Carl Jung. She realizes then that her unconscious, her number 2 personality, frightening and uncontrollable, is precisely the source of her inspiration.
We are split, like everybody. Everyone has a dark side. But which will prevail? How will Tommy and I get out of this ordeal? Grow up, I think.
In The Scapegoat, she really shows this better than in any, more obviously than in any other of her works. John and Jean, these are 2 parts of the same person. And she believes that the novel is about trying to put those 2 back together again, to mend them, if you like, which at that stage in her life she desperately needed, but never quite achieved.
Upon the publication of The Scapegoat, MGM buys the rights. The main roles are to be played by Alec Guinness and Bette Davis. But Daphne is disappointed by the scenario and decrees from the outset that the film will be a failure. A few days later, as they prepare to celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary, Tommy collapses.
She takes the train, she arrives in London, she arrives in a clinic, and there she finds her husband completely drained. She enters the London apartment, the phone rings,
And a woman says to her, "Are you Lady Browning? Your husband is in very bad shape. I'm your husband's mistress, and all of this is your fault."
Divorce is out of the question. Daphne leaves Menabili for several months in order to care for her husband in London, but she cannot accept being cheated on. She, who felt so guilty for being unfaithful herself, now feels terribly humiliated. Once Tommy can return to Buckingham Palace and Daphne to Menabili, she finds herself at wit's end.
After all that Daphne was doing to really set right her life in the late 1950s, when all this had happened, she writes to a friend, and these are her words, "The dark side has not yet been destroyed. We must be patient. I don't want to resurrect Rebecca," which really, at her wit's end, it is Rebecca once again that she is concerned not to resurrect. And the reason she's concerned is because she's terrified that Rebecca, as she put it, was returning to her, and that she would turn back into Rebecca, and that her husband would kill her as Maxim had killed Rebecca.
Tommy's health is declining by the day. They still make some trips to the sea and reform a certain bond, but in 1965, at the age of 69, Tommy dies. For Daphne, it is a shock. Her grief is immense. She is racked with remorse, and she blames herself for her selfishness and for having left him alone in London while in the grip of her romantic obsessions.
Quand il est malade au fin de sa vie, elle était magnifique. Elle s'occupait de lui, elle fait tout ce qu'elle pouvait faire pour lui. Et quand il est décédé, elle était vraiment tellement triste. Et elle a resté dans les vêtements noirs et blancs pour un an. Comme ça. Oui, elle pensait beaucoup à lui.
During this time of mourning, the only thought that comforts her is her belief that Tommy is waiting for her somewhere. She writes another series of short stories, among them, Don't Look Now.
I've always been fascinated by paranormal phenomena, although I am not a medium myself. I've never encountered ghosts, and I do not want to communicate with the beyond or anything like that. But I'm convinced that extrasensory perception exists. I like to call this faculty the sixth sense. It is a way of seeing and hearing between perception and intuition that allows us to grasp, in an indefinable way, what escapes us. Many of my stories have a paranormal aspect, notably, of course, Don't Look Now. The idea came to me during a stay in Venice. In this labyrinth of often narrow canals, there are alleys, bridges, and other rather eerie passages before arriving at San Marco. And as I was heading there one evening, I thought I saw a small child running along a canal, and I found that sinister.
Shortly after Tommy's death, Daphne is forced to leave her beloved Menabili. She moves to Kilmarth, also on the Rashleigh estate. When the BBC asks for an interview, surprisingly, she agrees. It is one of the rare appearances of Daphne du Maurier on television. When the reporter arrives at her home, he is nervous. He knows this is a great privilege.
No. Now, there's a lovely portrait of Tommy done by Gerald Kelly when he was about 25 years old, adjutant at Sandhurst.
Which was his regiment?
Grenadiers.
That's me at 15.
Who did that?
Paddington Man. Now, here's my bedroom. Lovely view.
Is that your working desk?
That's my bill desk, hence the litter.
Oh, the chores.
The chores desk. And here's my view.
Marvelous view.
Compensations.
This seems a large house for just one person.
No, it isn't really frightfully big, you know. Well, I'll show you around afterwards.
65th year. Are you aware of any decline in the working powers?
64. I suppose one should begin to decline a bit. Obviously, what one writes today isn't as fresh as it was when I was 21. I mean, one goes through different phases. But
I'm
not aware of sort of awful decline, kind of aching bones in the head, you know.
Do you think there is such a thing as a height of one's powers for a writer? Does a writer reach a certain kind of high point in their life?
Oh, I don't know. I believe writing's a thing you can go on doing right up to 80. I mean, look at Agatha Christie.
For instance, I mean, when you wrote Rebecca, you were, what, in your very early 30s?
Yes, but, I mean, that was just a phase, Rebecca was, and that happens to have been the most popular. It isn't, to my mind, the most mature by a long shot. Now, Wilfred, here we are in the old kitchen, which is now my archive room.
Oh, yes, these are all the manuscripts.
All the great works.
Glassblowers.
Glassblowers, Gerald, Jamaica Inn, Rebecca.
Rebecca. This is the actual manuscript of Rebecca.
Look at the faded old notes.
This was your original typescript.
Yes.
There it is. Last night I dreamt I went to Magdalene.
look at the
again.
Immature handwriting.
Yes.
Because I was rather immature, you know, all those years ago. And Rebecca scribbled on the top.
That's quite something.
Well,
we'll leave that
that's
there.
That. Yes, we can.
When she is told that the foundations of Kilmarth date back to the 14th century, she becomes enthralled with the previous occupants, a young woman, Isolde, and a chemist, whose vials she finds in the cellar. Over a few months, she writes The House on the Strand.
And actually, that is one of the best books she ever wrote. Being in bookends here over the years, you always think people will say, oh, my favourite was Rebecca, or, you know. But in actual fact, more people say The House on the Strand is their favourite book than any other. It's a masterpiece. It's brilliant.
After 25 years without getting behind the wheel, her need for independence encourages her to obtain again her driver's license. Daphne travels with her daughters and discovers the joy of being a grandmother. She is named Dame Commander of the Order of the British Empire. After The House on the Strand, Daphne writes biographies and a book about Cornwall with her son. But though she may visit places steeped in history, and she may confine herself to a strict work schedule, no mysterious characters would ever again disturb her thoughts. Rebecca has disappeared. In the springtime of 1989, Daphne stops eating. One afternoon, she calls on her family one last time and visits her dear country estate, Menabilly. When evening falls, she goes to bed without deviating from her routine. The following morning, she is found dead in bed. At 81, Daphne du Maurier was finally one with her imaginary world.
Old evil, loose my chains and let me rest where I am best, here in the muted shade of my own dust. But if I must go wandering in time and seek the source of my life force, lend me your sable wings that as I fall beyond recall, the sober stars can tumble in my wake, for Jesus' sake.